good. Okay, with that, we're going to go ahead and get into the sermon. There is a geologic concept that has probably affected you personally, and I am sure that it has affected your spiritual life even more. You might say, well, what is this? How does geology affect my spiritual life? Well, let's consider two terms, two definitions of two words. This is defined from the Wikipedia encyclopedia. I'm going to read for you the definition of the word uniformitarianism. Uniformitarianism. In the Wikipedia encyclopedia is as follows. Is a scientific principle that the same natural laws and processes that operate in the universe now have always operated in the universe of the past and apply everywhere in the universe. It has included the gradualistic concept that, quote, the present is the key to the past, unquote, and is functioning at the same rates. Uniformitarianism has been a key principle of geology in virtually all fields of science, but naturalism's modern geologists, while accepting that geology has occurred across deep time, no longer hold to a strict gradualism. Uniformitarianism, coined by William Whewell, was originally proposed in contrast to catastrophism by British naturalists in the late 18th century, starting with the work of the Scottish geologist James Hutton, which he refined by James Playfair and popularized by Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology in 1830. So there were some scientists in the 1800s that formulated the idea that what is occurring in the past and the way it's occurred in the past is the way things are occurring right now and the way things are occurring in the future. So everything is going along in the same slow rate. So if a river is being eroded down a quarter of an inch per year, then it'll be eroded down a quarter of an inch per year in 200 years, that same river. And therefore, if we know the rate that it's been eroded and how deep it is now, we can say how old and how long it's been eroding. For example, the Grand Canyon. They take the Grand Canyon, and they look at the top of the Grand Canyon. They look at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. They measure its depth. Then they figure out how fast the Grand Canyon River, the river at the bottom, is eroding away the strata. If it's so many centimeters or so many inches per year, then that's how long it's taken for the top of the Grand Canyon to be eroded down to make the canyon we have now, which gives him millions and millions of years of time. All right, this concept is actually covered in the Bible. Let's go to 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter, right before the book of Revelation and right before John. We have the book of Peter. And in 2 Peter, we're going to see what it says. 2 Peter chapter 3 and in verse 3. Knowing this, that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lusts. We already see that now, brethren. We're in the last days, and people are doing what they want according to their own lusts. Verse 4 of 2 Peter chapter 3. And saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. So they say, look, since everything has been created, since the beginning of time, things are just going along at the same old rate. Nothing changes. Nothing's different. Everything is going along at the same time. This is a biblical acknowledgement of the theory of uniformitarianism. And it says here, where is the promise of his coming? Christ is not going to come. You know, he hasn't come in the past. He's not going to come in the future. For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. So Christ, you know, if Christ has not come in the past, he's not coming now. He's not coming in the future. So uniformitarianism is a very, very important concept if you're a modern-day geologist, naturalist, and if you're an evolutionist. Because uniformitarianism provides you with the deep time you need for the minute changes to take place in evolution. Now, let's contrast that with another word. And this is the word catastrophism. are catastrophism. Once again, the fount of all knowledge, the Wikipedia. This is what it says about catastrophism. It is a theory that the Earth has been affected in the past by sudden, short-lived, violent events, possibly worldwide in scope. This was in contrast to uniformitarianism, sometimes described as gradualism, in which slow incremental changes, such as erosion, created all the Earth's geologic features. Uniformitarianism held that the present is the key to the past and that all things continue as they were from the indefinite past. Did you hear that little quote there in the Wikipedia? Sounds just like the Bible quote. Let me read it to you again. That all things continue as they were from the indefinite past. Let me read it to you out of Peter. For all things continue as they were from the beginning. That's almost like they looked at the scriptures to get this quote. Back to Wikipedia. All things continue as they were from the indefinite past. Since the early disputes, a more inclusive and integrated view of geological events has developed, in which the scientific consensus accepts that there were some catastrophes in the geologic past, but that these are extreme examples of natural processes which can occur. Catastrophism held that geologic epochs had ended with violent and sudden natural catastrophes such as great floods and the rapid formation of major mountain chains. Plants and animals living in the parts of the world which in these events occurred were killed off, being replaced abruptly by new forms whose fossils define the geologic strata. Some catastrophists attempted to relate at least one such change to the biblical account of Noah's flood. The concept was first popularized by the early 19th century French scientist Georges Cuvier, who proposed that new life forms had moved in from other areas after floods, and he avoided religious or metaphysical speculation in his writings. So we have two competing theories about the Earth. One is uniformitarianism, where things just continue as they always have been, and this term is mentioned here in the book of 2 Peter. And then we have catastrophism, which states that the Earth has been affected in the past by large violent upheavals, and that this has caused changes in the Earth. Now, for example, let's take mountain building. Mountains are, there's two ways that mountains can be built. One way is we have tectonic plates, and the tectonic plates, the Earth has got plates, and these plates are moving because the magma, have you ever seen boiling water? There's a pattern to the boiling water. It's in a circle like this in the pan, okay? And the Earth's magma is very hot and moving in the same way, so there's forces that are hitting the Earth's surface created by this magma that's flowing underneath in convection cells. And this magma is hitting the plates and moving the plates. And the plates are moving, and when they hit, they buckle up, and there's where we get our mountains. Now, what happens if the plates are moving very slowly? Then we get mountains being built up very slowly. If the plates are moving very fast, we're going to get the mountains created very fast. So depending on which theory you believe in, uniformitarianism or catastrophism, it's in effect your view of how things occurred in the past on the Earth. The formation of the strata, the formation of the mountains, the dating of the fossils that are in the strata, so forth and so on. Now, consider that evolution is based on uniformitarianism. Evolution is based on uniformitarianism. Because evolution needs what? It needs lots of time. There were minor changes over long epochs of time. You remember in a sermon in the past that I gave you, I mentioned that Charles Darwin once said that if a bear was in the water catching flies and swimming around and had enough time, the bear would be converted into a whale. Little time, I told you what the title of the sermon was, Evolution, a Fairy Tale for Adults. And that's basically what evolution says. With enough time, animals can be converted from one form into another. So evolution needs large amounts of time for these little minute changes to add up and take place. I'm not saying evolution is true. I'm saying that's what evolution needs. Evolution also needs times that is not filled with catastrophes, because catastrophes are going to interrupt the evolutionary process. If things are going along very, 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 very slowly, and we're going from one organism to another from a biological point of view, and then there's a meteorite that hits the earth and destroys it and wipes off life off the face of the earth, that's interrupted evolution. So we can't have catastrophes like that, of great floods like that occurring, because that throws a wrench into this gradual process. Also, evolution needs the following. Fossils were laid down slowly over vast periods of time. If the strata is being produced very, very slowly, over thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years, if the strata is being formed very slowly, then the fossils on the bottom of the strata and the fossils on the top of the strata are going to have different ages, because they've been laid down at different times. And different stratas or different layers that are above and below are going to have different times. Now, if the strata is laid down catastrophically, very quickly, within a few weeks or months or years, then the timing is going to be different than if it's uniformitarianism. So therefore, what evolutionists need is they need the fossils to be laid down slowly over vast periods of time, so they're in agreement with uniformitarianism. They also need, and I mentioned this, that the strata used to date the fossils was laid down over long periods of time. If catastrophes lay down the strata quickly, then the dating is off and the evolutionary theory is not correct, because it throws a big wrench into the laying down of these fossils. What's my point of all of this? In this sermon, we're going to look at this concept, and this is a concept we're going to look at today. Is the Bible a uniformitarian book, or is the Bible a catastrophic book? In other words, if we look at the Bible as an overall piece of literature, do we see in the Bible and its writings where things occur very gradually and very slowly? Or when we look at the Bible, do we see things that occur in a catastrophic way? So that's what we're going to do in this sermon. Many readers of the Bible are unaware of the magnitude of catastrophism that is mentioned in the scriptures. The Bible is a very catastrophically oriented book. Bear this in mind as you examine the biblical evidence presented. Some of the themes discussed here may be considered overdramatic, but in reality, what occurred during the flood of Noah and other catastrophes is probably beyond human comprehension. There have been many past catastrophes, and there are many yet to occur. The following are just a few examples in the biblical record. So let's look at some catastrophes mentioned in the Old Testament. Let's look at some catastrophes. Let's go to Psalms. Sometimes we read these scriptures and we read them and we go, wow, that's like poetic language. And that's really interesting, the way that, you know, the metaphors of this and the metaphors of that and the analogies that the writer puts forth. And instead, we need to read it as literal writing. As literal writing. Let's go to Psalms 46. And we're going to look at the question in the Old Testament, is the Bible catastrophic according to the Old Testament? Psalms 46. You know, you sing about these catastrophes when you sing out of the hymn book. You may not even know you're doing it, but you are. Psalms 46, verse 1. God is my refuge and my strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, even though the earth be removed, and even though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling. Now here we have a description of the mountains being thrown into the sea, and we have here a description of the mountains shaking. Now, I wager to you that that's a pretty catastrophic event if you have the mountains being funneled into the sea. And there's actually a hymn that I think that's part of the verses in the hymn that we sing. And we sing it and we say, oh, that's very nice, poetic language. Well, imagine you're living on these mountains when the mountains are rushing headlong into the sea. Would you think that would be a catastrophe? Of course you would. You're living on the mountains and all this is rushing into the sea. Do you remember a few years ago, I was thinking it was just a couple of years, but it's been almost very many years, where we had the tsunami that washed up on Japan? And it messed around with one of the nuclear reactors over there. There was a big stink about all of that. Do you remember that the scientists measured Japan and they measured the fact that Japan had actually moved a couple of feet? And the reason they did that is because Japan is on plates. The nation of Japan is a mountainous region. It's actually volcanic islands, Japan is. Like Fiji and Hawaii and the Sandwich Islands and various other islands in the Pacific, their lava that's bubbled up, hardened, bubbled up more, and then spread out. Erosion, soil, and animals and plants have taken refuge on that island. So Japan is actually a chain of mountains that are volcanic. There's plates, and Japan is on the edge of plates, on the edge of one of these plates. The earthquake took place, it moved the plates. The plate that Japan was on moved by a couple of feet. So therefore, and it was very gradual over the course of many days, but therefore, Japan actually moved. All right. Now, if you move the plates fast enough, some of the plates are going underneath other plates. If you move the plates fast enough, they're going to dive down under other plates. And if there had been a big enough earthquake, or for example, an asteroid that would hit the Earth, the asteroid would buckle the plates and move them at very fast velocities, many hundreds of miles per hour, and then these plates would subduct under each other, and the mountains would be carried into the seas. Everybody with me? This is what we have here being described. Even though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the seas, once again, do not make something literal poetic. This is actually describing a catastrophe that occurred in the past. Let's go to Psalm 74. We're answering the question, is the Old Testament a catastrophic book? Psalm 74. You know, we live, let's say we live from 1950 to 2030. We live those 80 years. And during those 80 years, nothing dramatic happens. Are we then safe to say that in the thousands of years before and the thousands of years after, that it's going to be just the same as it was when we were alive for 80 years? That's very egotistical, because everything revolves around me. And, you know, that's what men have done. They've said, well, since these things are occurring at this rate during my 30 years of observation, therefore, they must be occurring at this rate for the 30 million years before and after, which is the dates they give things. And that, once again, is being very egotistical, that, you know, I am the center of everything. Let's go to Psalm 74 and verse 13. You divided the sea by your strength. You broke the heads of the sea, serpents in the water. You broke the heads of Leviathan in pieces. Leviathan was some kind of great sea creature. And here, Leviathan is being broken up into pieces. You gave him as food to the people inhabiting the wilderness. You broke open the fountains and the flood. You dried up mighty rivers. The day is yours, the night also is yours. You have prepared the light and the sun. You have set all the borders of the earth. Notice verse 17. You have made summer and winter. Summer and winter were created, brethren. Hold your place there. Let's go to Genesis chapter 8. Genesis chapter 8. Genesis chapter 8. And Genesis chapter 8. This is the discussion that God was having with Noah after the flood. Genesis chapter 8, verse 22. Notice verse 20. We have Noah building an altar. He took of every clean bird and every clean animal, offered it on the altar. That's why there were seven of those clean and only two of the unclean. When after you sacrificed the one clean one, you had three pair of clean. And since clean were animals that were eaten, there was going to be more of them so they could populate the earth faster. Another subject. Verse 21, and the Lord smelled a sweet-smelling aroma. Then the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. In other words, I'm never going to send another flood. And he put the rainbow in the sky. You remember that? Notice the next verse, verse 22. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease. What this indicates here is that the winter and summer were started at this time and have continued from this time forward. You know what causes winter and summer? Was Eden tropical? Yes, you know, they ran around naked until sin entered the picture. It was a perfect 72 degrees, perfect humidity, perfect wind, perfect temperature. So Eden was very tropical. Winter and summer are not tropical. Winter and summer are snow and hot and heat. So what happened is the earth's axis has to shift. And you have to have the earth at an angle to the sun for it to rotate and for it to heat unevenly, for the wind systems to be created, and for winter and summer to occur. So we go from the axis of the earth being probably perpendicular to them being curved and moved, and this creates winter and summer. So winter and summer, if the earth's axis moved, winter and summer are the result of a catastrophic moving of the earth. Let's keep reading. And Psalms 97, let's go back to Psalms. I told you to keep your place there. Let's go back to Psalms 97. We're answering the question about the Old Testament. It is catastrophic. Psalms 97. Verse 1. The Lord reigns. Let the earth rejoice. Let the multitude of isles be glad. Clouds and darkness surround him. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of his throne. A fire goes before him and burns up his enemies round about. And his lightnings light the world. The earth sees and trembles. The mountains melt like wax at the presence of the Lord. At the presence of the Lord, the whole earth. So what happens when Jesus Christ returns? What's going to happen to the mountains? The mountains are going to melt. Now we read that and we go like, oh, that's really interesting, you know, about Jesus Christ returning and about righteousness and, you know, all these other things that are going to happen. And we read right over the mountains melting like wax. If you're living on the mountains and they're 17,000, 18,000 feet high and they begin to fall into the sea, into the sea level or into the sea, is that a catastrophe for you? Oh, you bet it is. It all depends on your point of view, brethren, you know. The billiard ball being thrown into the fire is not a catastrophe for you. But if you're a virus living on the billiard ball, then your world is ending. So right here we have, at Jesus Christ's return, the earth sees and trembles, the mountains melt like wax at God's presence when he returns. So at Jesus Christ's return, the Old Testament says that the mountain chains are going to be lowered. Psalms 104, forward a few pages. Psalms 104, beginning to read in verse 1. Now, before we read this, let me give you something to think about. Jesus Christ was the God of the Old Testament. Jesus Christ was the creator in Genesis chapter 1, verse 3 on. It says in the book of Colossians that Christ created everything. All right. So Christ has created all things that exist. There was a world that existed before Adam, the pre-Adamic world. We've had Bible studies on those. And the pre-Adamic world was destroyed by the flood, by a flood. Not the flood of Noah, but a flood. We read in the beginning was the heavens and the earth, and the earth was not form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. The earth was covered by a deep mantle of water. That's why he has to, you know, raise up the land. There was land and water, because before there was only water. One of the things he said was, you know, let there be light. Another thing he said was, I'm going to create a dry earth, because there wasn't any. There was, the whole earth was covered by water. So there was a flood that covered the earth before man came into existence. And then there was a flood that covered the earth after man came into existence, and he rebelled and became evil, and that was a flood of Noah, correct? So there's two times that the earth has been covered by water. Now, in the second flood that we read about in Genesis chapter 6, we just read about it, God says that he's never again going to destroy the earth with water, right? So, let's read that understanding of the context, because that little point I just talked to you about is going to show us some things about what we're going to read here in Psalms chapter 104, verse 1. Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with honor and majesty, who cover yourselves with light as with a garment, who stretched out the heavens like a curtain. He lays the beams of his upper chambers in the waters, who makes his clouds his chariot. He walks on the wings of wind. He makes his angels spirits, his ministers a flame of fire. You who laid the foundation of the earth, Jesus Christ, so that it should not be moved forever, you covered it with deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At the voice of your thunder, they hastened away. Now, let me ask you a question. This right here, is this referring to the first flood or the second flood? Let's keep reading. Verse 7, at your rebuke they fled, at the voice of your thunders they hastened away. They went up over the mountains, they went down into the valleys. This is the water, that's the they is the water. To the place which you founded for them, you have set a boundary that they may not pass over, that they may not return to cover the earth. Now, if this is saying in verse 9 that the previous scriptures are encumbered with verse 9 where it says, you shall not, that they may not return to cover the earth, this is actually the flood of Noah. Because if it was the flood of the first flood, he couldn't say that. He couldn't say, during this flood, I'm not going to let the earth, I'm not going to let the floods return back over the earth. Because he knew he was going to do that in Genesis chapter 6. So what I'm getting at here in verse 1 through 9, this is talking about the flood of Noah. All right, now I want you to notice something. This is the flood of Noah, as we can understand by verse 9. Notice verse 9. You have set the boundaries that they may not pass over, that they shall not return to cover the earth. So they're not ever going to cover the earth again. So if this description here is about not covering the earth again, this has to be the second flood, not the first. Since it's the second flood, it's Noah's flood. Notice verse 8. They went up over the mountains, they went down into the valleys. Now I have a new King James Version. I don't know what's in the King James Version, but mine has a marginal rendering. Go to the margin. There's probably a little note there if you have the New King James, and it says, in verse 8, are the mountains rose up, the valley sank down. So where did the water go for the flood? Well, the water that covered the earth and covered the mountains, what happened is the valley sank and the mountains rose. And as the valley sank and the mountains rose, the valleys became the receptacle for the seawater, for the water that covered the earth. So the water flowed into the valleys. So we have the continental shelves, and we have the water being into the oceans. Where is the water that covered the earth during the flood? It's in the seas. That's where the water is. It didn't evaporate off. You know, God didn't make it disappear. It went into the oceans. So, question. The mountains rising up and the valleys being lowered in a very short amount of time for it to contain the waters of the flood, would this be catastrophic or uniformitarianism? Catastrophic. It's catastrophe. You know, if you're on the bottom of this valley, you're going to have millions of gallons, you know, 2 or 3 miles of water covering you. What's it going to do? It's going to gouge out large canyons. They say that where the Hudson Bay River, you know, up near the Great Lakes, goes into the Atlantic Ocean, that if you drain the water from the continents and you look at where the Hudson Bay River goes into the ocean, that there's a canyon there deeper than the Grand Canyon. What happened? Well, as the waters were rising, as the mountains were rising and the seabeds were lowering, the waters were coming off of the continental shelves, you know, through the spillway of the Hudson River, And they were gouging out all the soft mud that was there. And then as the waters rose up, it buried the canyon that was formed. And we don't see it. But when you get home, Google Hudson Bay Canyon or river or whatever and do some investigating. You'll find that there's a canyon there deeper than the Grand Canyon. So probably it was formed during the time that the water was receding off the face of the earth. What I want you to notice is verse 8. It says, they went up over the mountains and went down into the valleys. It should read, the mountains rose up, the valleys went down. That's where the water for the flood went. Let's go to verse 31, same chapter. May the glory of the Lord endure forever. May the Lord rejoice in his works. He looks on the earth and it trembles. He touches the hills and they smoke. You know, hills smoking is, what do we call that? Volcanoes. You know, you got earthquakes and you got volcanoes. God just looks at the earth and there's volcanoes and earthquakes. So all of those are catastrophic themes. Let's go to Psalms 114. One of the psalms, hymns we sing. Psalm 114. This is... mine has power of God in his deliverance of Israel. Or some say when Israel went out of Egypt. When did Israel go out of Egypt? The Exodus. But not right. The 10 plagues. Death of the firstborn and all of that. Verse 1. When Israel went out of Egypt, the house of Jacob from the people of strange language, Judah became a sanctuary and Israel his dominion. The sea saw it and fled. What causes the Red Sea... You know, during the crossing the Red Sea. You know, we have this image because of the Ten Commandments of them walking through this canal and there's water all up and down them. What actually happened, it says that the Red Sea receded. You know, the Red Sea is now way over there and we're going to walk across it dry. This is what it's saying here in 114. It says, saw it and fled. Jordan turned back. So the River Jordan reversed its course. What would you say if the Mississippi River reversed its course? Would that be catastrophic? Oh yeah, you'd have to have the lowering of large amounts of landmass or the raising up of large amounts of landmass or some other catastrophic event to cause the water to reverse its directions. You know, we read this and we say, oh, the Jordan turned back. How cute. And we sing that, you know, the river, you know, the lamb skipped and the Jordan turned back and all that. And we sing that. And we should, but we're not really thinking about what it means. The mountains skipped like rams. You're a shepherd. You're on top of a hill. You're looking down onto your flock of sheep. There's an embankment or a small fence. And the lambs are going to jump over it. And they jump over it like in a wave. So you see this lambs skipping. That's what it means. You know, the lambs skip. You know, the lambs aren't really skipping. You know, walking and skipping. What's happening is the lambs are jumping over this barrier and it looks like they're skipping. So when you told a shepherd the lambs are skipping, he knew exactly what you meant. Now, notice what it says in verse 4. The mountains skip like rams. So we have the mountains that are doing this. You know, they're moving up and down. The mountains are moving up and down. Is that catastrophic? You bet it is. The mountains skip like rams. The little hills like lambs. The mountains look like rams. The little hills, because of these earth shakes or earth tremors or whatever was happening, readjustment of the earth's crust or whatever, they look like, the little hills look like little lambs. What ails you, O sea, that you fled? In other words, where did you go? What happened to the sea? O Jordan, that you turned back. O mountains, that you skip like rams. O little hills, like lambs. Tremble, O earth, at the presence of the Lord, at the presence of the God of Jacob, who turned the rock into a pool of water and flint into the fountain of water. Jesus Christ has the power to make the mountains skip like little rams. He has the power to make the Jordan turn back. He has the power to make the sea flee so that the children of Israel could cross over it. All of these are catastrophic events, brother. Now, how exactly he did it, we don't know. We don't know the mechanics. But he could have opened up a big part of the earth. The earth could have swallowed up all the water, made the earth dry so that they could come across. Then he covers up the hole and the water's refilled. Or there could have been a passing of a large celestial body. What do we have every time the moon cuts by us? Tides. So we've got these large planetary tides now, and now instead of the tides moving a few feet or a few inches in the case of the Jordan or the sea, the whole sea moves. I mean, there's lots of ways this could happen. I'm not trying to explain how it happened. I'm just telling you what happened. And what I want you to notice is when we sing these psalms, and the next time you sing one of these psalms, think about what it's really saying. The Bible is not a uniformitarian-based book. The Bible is a catastrophic book. Most of your great scientists in the past were catastrophists. They believed that the earth had been through lots of catastrophes because they were what? Bible believers. They read their Bible. Let's go to Job chapter 9. Job chapter 9. Job chapter 9. Job chapter 9. God is having this discussion with Job. Job chapter 9, verse 5. He refers to God. He removes the mountains, and they do not know when he overturns them in his anger. He shakes the earth out of its place, and its pillars tremble. He commands the sun, and it does not rise. He seals off the stars. He alone spreads out the heavens. So if he shakes the earth out of its place, what does that mean? Don't think poetic. Think literal. If he shakes the earth out of its place, that means the earth is moving out of its place that it was. So the orbit is being changed. Or the inclination of the axis is being changed. You know, you have animals that live in tropical climates and tropical plants, you have them buried in near the North Pole. When some of the polar explorers went to the North Pole and around there, they bore down. They had equipment that would bore and core the earth. And they pull up palms and seeds and plants that live where it's tropical. Well, if the tropics are right here and then the earth shifts up here, now the things that were in the tropics are now in the North Pole. And then they get covered by ice and all of that other stuff. So when it says here in verse 5, he removes the mountains. He overturns the mountains in anger. I mean, he's flipping the mountains like pancakes. We read that and we go, how quaint. How interesting. That has a nice sound to it. Well, imagine you're living on the mountains when God decides to flip them over like pancakes. He shakes the earth out of its place, or earth moved. You know, if you move the earth further or closer to the sun, you have to increase the speed of the revolution around the sun so that it stays in orbit. If it's closer, the speed has to increase. If it's farther away, the speed has to decrease. If it doesn't, then it'll go off into space or into the sun. So that means that if we were right here at one time and the earth moved in closer, then the year would be shorter. If we were right here and the earth was moved out, then the year would be longer. So it would take longer to get around the earth. They say that in the past, the Babylonians and various other people said that the ancients had a 360-day calendar made up of 12 months of 30 days. Now we have a 365-and-a-quarter day and some change calendar. Because what happened? The earth was moved from this place out a little further, which means now the earth is going to take longer to go around the earth, the 5.5 days, instead of the 360. That we have 365, which makes us have leap years and all kinds of things for the holy day calendar. When Jesus Christ returns, is he going to set everything back the way it was? The restoration of all things? There's not going to be any calendar problems when he returns because he's going to realign the sun and the moon and the stars. But what I'm getting at, the fact that we have a 365 and a half day, 365 and a quarter day year, and ancient sources tell us there was 360 in the past, means that the Earth has been moved out of its orbit somewhat. This is what it's saying right here in Job chapter 9. He removes the mountains. He overturns them in his anger. He shakes the earth out of its place. Its pillars tremble. He comes as a man's sun, and it does not rise. If the sun does not rise, that means, now, we think the sun rises. You ever been in the parking lot, and you're sitting in your car, and there's a car next to you, and you go, oh, we're moving. And it's not you moving, it's the other person moving. Oh, dude, with the brakes, put the brakes on. It's not you, the other car's backing up, and you think you're going forward. The sun doesn't move, brethren. We're rotating. So it looks like the sun is moving. So if it says here that the sun doesn't rise, that means that the rotation of the earth has been affected. If the rotation of the earth has been affected, is that uniformitarianism? No, that's some kind of catastrophe affecting the orbit and the placement of the earth. Once again, I'm not trying to tell you how this occurred or why it occurred. I'm just showing you that it did occur. He commands the sun, it does not rise, in verse 7. And various other things happen. One more in Job 38. Job 38. You know, when you go to high school or college, they'll tell you that uniformitarianism is very, very important, that it's which all the sciences are based. And uniformitarianism does not exist, brethren. The earth hasn't been going along for millions of years at the same rate it's going along now. There's been past catastrophes. Job chapter 38. This is where Job gets a lecture by God. Job chapter 38, notice verse 1. Then the Lord answered Job out of a whirlwind and said, who do you think you are, Job? You're just a little puny peepsqueak. Verse 4. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Verse 8. Or shut the sea and its doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling cloth, when I fixed my limit for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far you may come, but no further, and your proud ways would stop. God corralled up the sea. You remember the valleys sinking down? He made a barrier for the sea so that it would not go over the earth anymore. Here, your proud waves must stop. That's catastrophic right there. Now, we're not even going to talk about the flood of Noah. Well, let's go ahead and talk about that just a little. Let's go to Genesis chapter 6, because some of you are under a mistaken impression. Genesis chapter 6. You know, God, we know the story. God's going to destroy the earth. God's going to destroy mankind. Mankind's become evil. He's going to send the flood. We're looking at Genesis chapter 6. Notice verse 11. The earth was also corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. That's why he sent the flood, because men were violent. Verse 12. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them. So he's going to destroy them. Who's the them? The men. But we should not stop reading. Keep reading. I will destroy them with the earth. The earth, brethren, was destroyed by the flood of Noah. You know, we have this concept, 40 days and 40 nights of rain. You know, it rained a little bit. The creeks kind of rose a little. The rivers were a couple of feet over the banks. Maybe the Nile and the Mississippi overflowed their boundaries, and there was flooding here and there. But, you know, things dried up after a few days, and life went on. No, my friends. The flood, no pun intended, was a watershed event. It destroyed the earth. How do we know that? Because it says that right there, that it was destroyed. The earth was destroyed. Let's go to Genesis chapter 1. I mentioned this, but let's read it. Verse 2, the earth became, as it should read, as we had other Bible studies, the earth became without form and void, chaotic and confused. The earth became a waste. And darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. That's one of the reasons God had to say, let me make dry land. because there wasn't any. The earth was covered by a flood at this time. Once again, a catastrophic event. You know, the earth getting covered by water is going to destroy all life on the earth. They had the Devonian period. So many millions of years ago, where there was a lot of the age of fishes. The Devonian period wasn't the age of fishes. The Devonian period was when the flood occurred, this one, strata was laid down, and large amounts of fish were buried in strata. So once again, we have two great worldwide catastrophes, one in Genesis chapter 1, one in Genesis chapter 6. So now, point one is, we've looked at the catastrophes mentioned in the Old Testament, and we haven't even looked at all of them, just a few of them. There's actually hundreds of them in the Old Testament. Now let's look at catastrophes when Jesus Christ returns. You know, there are people that are saying, Protestants, that are saying, you know, you go to bed tonight, you better be careful because God could return in the middle of the night. Jesus is going to return tonight. You know, he can return. Is your soul saved, brother? Because Jesus can return at any time. No, Jesus cannot return at any time. Jesus has a plan. He has a timetable. Let's go to and look at this following theme. Point number two, catastrophes at the return of Jesus Christ. Catastrophes at the return of Jesus Christ. The return of Jesus Christ occurs during a time of global catastrophes. Some events that are prophesied to occur when he returns includes the following: earthquakes, tidal destruction, heavenly signs, tectonic readjustments, and various other catastrophic events. Jesus returns during a great crisis period, which is called the Day of the Lord, and this Day of the Lord engulfs all the world in total. Let's look at some of the events of the Day of the Lord. Isaiah. Now, these are prophecies of when Jesus Christ returns. So this fit the theme of prophecy of catastrophes at the return of Jesus Christ. Isaiah chapter 2. Isaiah chapter 2. Isaiah chapter 2. And we're going to read in verse 17. The loftiness of man shall be bowed down, and the haughtiness of men shall be brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. The day, if you read mine, if you go across to about verse number 5, mine has a little heading, says the Day of the Lord, right up there. That little comment there that's added by the translators of the Bible. The Day of the Lord. So in verse 17, we're looking at the context of the events that occur in the Day of the Lord. In that day, what day? The Day of the Lord. That's the context. Let's read in verse 19. They will go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth from the terror of the Lord and the glory of his majesty when he arises to shake the earth mightily. You ever watch these films, somewhat scientifically based, where there's this giant asteroid or comet that's going to hit the earth? Been several of them made the last few years. And where do all the rich people and the presidents and the politicians hide? In caves of the earth. We've got this great mountain cavern. We've been, you know, hollowing it out for the last 10 years. And, you know, you need a pass to get in there. And that's going to save humanity. You know why they do that in the movies? Because the best place to hide from an asteroid or a comet is in a hole in the earth. You ever read about that in the New Testament somewhere, maybe? This is Isaiah's prophesying about that. Verse 20. In that day, what day? The Day of the Lord, when men are hiding in the caves of the earth, a man will cast away his idols of silver, his idols of gold, which they made, each for himself to worship, to the moles and to the bats, to go into the clefts of the rocks and to the crags of the rugged rocks, from the terror of the Lord and the glory of his majesty, when he arises to shake the earth mightily. You ever seen somebody shaking out a rug? Dust and stuff flying all over the place? That's what God's going to do to the earth. He's going to shake it. He's going to shake it. And people are going to hide in the caves and the dens of the earth. Why are they doing that? We'll read about that later on in a minute. Let's go to Isaiah 24. This is during the Day of the Lord when Jesus Christ returns. Isaiah 24. These are prophetic, but they still concern the Day of the Lord. Isaiah 24, verse 1. Behold, the Lord makes the earth empty and makes it waste, distorts its surface and scatters abroad its inhabitants. When Jesus Christ returns, there's going to be a time of great worldwide trouble, brethren. Notice verse 4. The earth mourns and fades away. The world languishes and fades away. The haughty people of the earth languish. The earth is also defiled under its inhabitants because they have transgressed the laws. Which laws? Is it okay to commit adultery nowadays? Yeah. Is it okay to steal? Yeah. Is it okay to use the bathroom wherever you want? Is it okay for you to thumb God and declare what your sexuality is? Are some of the lifestyles, some of the death styles in the past now being accepted as proper lifestyles? Now, the earth is also defiled under its inhabitants because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinances, broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore, the curse has devoured the earth. And those who dwell in it are desolate. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned and few men are left. When Jesus Christ returns, brethren, it's not a time where people are going to be, jumping around, happy, holding flowers to greet the returning Christ. It's going to be a time of worldwide trouble, brethren. You ever read in the Bible somewhere about where the church has to be protected? Has to be taken to a place of safety? You ever read about that? You ever wonder why? Why doesn't God just protect us where we are? Well, if a comet or a meteorite is going to hit the earth in a certain location, you can't be in that location. You have to be somewhere else. That's why you can't be protected where you are. You got to be protected where God puts you. Let's look at verse 18. And it shall be that he who flees from the noise of the fear shall fall into the pit. And he who comes up from the midst of the pit shall be caught in the snare. For the windows from on high are open, and the foundations of the earth are shaken. What are the windows from on high? That's the heavens. The windows from on high is like saying that heavens are opened up for destruction. And the foundations of the earth are shaken. The earth is violently broken. The earth is split open. The earth is shaken exceedingly. This all occurs when Jesus Christ returns. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard. Axis is going to change. And shall totter like a hut. Its transgressions shall be heavy upon it. And it shall fall and not rise up. It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord will punish on high the host of exalted ones, and on the earth the kings of the earth. Jesus Christ is going to come, remove those kings from power, and implement a new kingdom. But when he returns, brethren, it's going to be a time of uniformitarianism? No, catastrophes worldwide. Let's go to Matthew chapter 24. We're looking at catastrophes that occur when he returns. Matthew 24. And we're looking at Matthew 24. Remember, we talked about the windows of heaven being opened? Matthew 24, verse 29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. There's going to be heavenly signs, brethren, when Jesus Christ returns. It's not business as usual. It's going to be a time of worldwide calamities. Luke chapter 21, a parallel harmonious scripture. Luke chapter 21. We're looking at the events when Jesus Christ returns. Luke chapter 21. Verse 25. And there will be signs in the sun and in the moon and on the earth, And there shall be signs in the sun and the moon and in the stars and on the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the seas and the waves roaring. Let me ask you a question. Let's say that the president announced today that they had discovered an asteroid that was coming towards the earth, and that the asteroid was going to hit us in 7 months. And it was going to hit Australia and probably the asteroid's about the size of Mount Everest, 7-8 miles across. And it's going to hit Australia going about 15 miles per second. And it's going to rip a hole in Australia about the size of the moon and destroy all of life on Earth. What would your heart be like? Notice verse 26. Men's hearts failing them from fear and the expectation of those things which are coming on the earth. For the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then Jesus Christ is going to return. So Jesus Christ has got to get the attention of the world, brethren. I mean, just, you know, we reread this and we say, boy, that's really poetic language. It's not poetic, brethren. It's literal. There are catastrophes that are coming upon the earth at the time period when Jesus Christ returns. We can read about them in the Bible. Now, we've got the first point is that the Bible is a catastrophic book in the Old Testament. We've got the second point that the Bible shows that there's going to be catastrophes when Jesus Christ returns. Third point, look at some of the catastrophes mentioned in the book of Revelation. In the book of Revelation. Future prophetic events seem to indicate destruction coming from the sky. Possible scenarios include the earth being struck by meteors, comets, its orbit being perturbed by the passing of various astronomical bodies. This would devastate the earth through gravitational and tidal forces. Astral impacts would likely have earthwide consequences for humanity and the ecosystem. Let's consider a few examples in the book of Revelation. You know, a lot of people say, man, the tribulation is going to be really tough on God's people. You know, I don't know if I can hang with God's people during this time. Well, brethren, if you don't hang with God's people at this time, you are going to be destroyed in the calamities that come upon the earth when Jesus Christ returns. And I would rather put myself in God's hands than make a league or a pact with Satan to give up my religion because things are getting tough religiously. Revelation chapter 6. Revelation chapter 6. Revelation chapter 6. Verse 12. I looked, and when he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake. And the sun became black as a sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood. You know why the moon and the sun become black and don't give their light? Because there's a lot of dust in the atmosphere. What puts dust in the atmosphere? Things coming from outer space hitting the earth, putting up tons and tons of material. Earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. When Krakatoa exploded, the sun and the moon were red for 7 years after, until all the dust settled from around the world. I mean, sunsets were fantastically brilliant in the United States when Krakatoa exploded thousands of miles away, because there was dust in the atmosphere, and it took years for it to settle out of the stratosphere. And the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became black like blood, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth as a fig tree drops its figs when it is shaken by the wind. Then the sky receded as a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island was moved out of its place. You know, you read about every island and mountain being moved out of its place. How is that possible? You remember Japan? You remember Japan moving? You remember Japan being on plates? You remember the mountains being on plates? We have an earth, we have an asteroid that hits the earth. The plates are moved hundreds of miles per hour as there's this giant explosion, and the earth tries to recoil from the explosion. And what happens? These plates are moving. So from the sky, you're going to see the islands and the mountains literally moving. Look at the islands, and they're moving. Now, you're looking at that from outer space. What if you're living on the mountains or the islands? Is that a catastrophic event? You bet it is. And it's talking about it right here. Verse 14, then the sky receded as a scroll and is rolled up, and every mountain and island was moved out of its place. And then, why is this happening? Then the kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave and every free man hid themselves in caves and in rocks of the earth, and said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand? The men who are living on the earth are going to say, Jesus Christ is returning. We've been prophesied that he's going to return. All these events have been prophesied. We see these astral events hitting the earth. We're going to hide in the caves and the dens of the earth because Jesus Christ is returning and there's coming a great day that we've been hearing about. You heard about the two witnesses preaching? What are the two witnesses going to be? Why are the two witnesses preaching? The two witnesses are preaching, brethren, because God's church is in a place protected. And God's church cannot preach. Because if God's church was preaching, the beast power, Revelation 13, would kill God's people. So God puts his people into a place of protection, away from wherever these things are going to occur. Where that is, we don't know. And then what's going to happen is the two witnesses are going to prophesy about, unless you repent, great false beast power, great false church, you're going to be destroyed by the coming return of Jesus Christ. So these men have been hearing about that, and they're going to say, oh, it's just like we've been told. Let's find somewhere in the cave of the earth to hide, because there's coming all of these astral catastrophes we've been warned about. Metaphors, brethren. These are to be taken literally, because that's what's going to happen when Jesus Christ returns. You know why people don't want to take the book of Revelation literally? Because if they do, then what we're talking about is true. Let's go to Revelation chapter 8, verse 7. These are the trumpets. The first angel sounded, and hail and fire followed, mingled with blood, and they were thrown to the earth. And a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. We've got hail and fire. You know that comets are made up of ice? Big snowballs. You got a snowball hitting you, somebody throws at you, no problem. But you put that snowball, you have that snowball hitting you at 17 miles per second, you will be just a red splotch on the snow. And that's what's going to happen. The earth is going to do what? Notice, hail and fire. If a comet were to hit the earth, the snow or the ice and the hail or the rocks would devastate the earth. So we'd have, coming out of the sky, rocks, hail, and snow, or ice. It's very, when you read it from a scientific point of view, it's very interesting, brother. Verse 8, this is the first angel. Then the second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea. What is something like a great mountain? If it comes and hits the sea, 66%, 75% of the earth is covered by water. So if an asteroid or a comet's going to hit the earth, 75% chance it's going to hit where? Water. So we got this asteroid that looks like a great mountain. That's an asteroid, brethren. A great mountain striking the earth and hitting the waters is an asteroid strike. Go online and find out what would happen if the earth was hit by a nice-sized 5-mile-wide asteroid. It would probably devastate the hemisphere it struck on. All life on that side of the planet would be destroyed. That's what they say happened to the dinosaurs. Verse 9, a third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. You know what happens when a comet hits the waters of the earth? The nitrogen in the water and the carbon in the water mix, and we have cyanide produced, which turns the water red. Does cyanide poison things? So we got red water that's poisoning things. Verse 10, then the third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch. What do you call a star that's got a torch on it, like a tail in the sky? Comet. So here we have a comet. Then the third angel sounded, and a comet from heaven, burning like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the waters because it was made bitter. Then the fourth angel said, we have all these astral catastrophes hitting the earth. Is dust going to be created on the earth? Mm-hmm. What's going to happen to the sun, the moon, and the stars? You remember a few years ago there was this blood moon scenario, and the blood moons are coming, and they're coming on certain holy days, and they're going to portend that Jesus Christ is returning. And I gave you several sermons showing that they were not correct, because blood moons can occur sometimes other than eclipses. There's a, what causes a blood moon right here, all the dust in the atmosphere, verse 12. Then the fourth angel sounded, and a third of the sun was struck, and a third of the moon, a third of the stars, so a third of them were darkened, and a third of the day did not shine, and likewise the night. And I looked, and I heard the angel flying through the midst of the heaven, saying, whoa, 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 this is not even as bad as it gets. The events that I've read you here in from verse 6 on to about verse 13, are they catastrophic? Yes, they are. Very catastrophic. One, a couple more scriptures. Revelation 16. This is the events that occur when Jesus Christ returns. This is why, brethren, the church has to be protected. Revelation 16, verse 18. And there were noises and thunderings and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, and a mighty great earthquake has not occurred since men were on the earth. Now the great city was divided into three parts, and the city of the nations fell. All the nations, all the great cities, Rio de Janeiro, New York, Houston, all of them are going to be destroyed. How do I know that? Because it says that right here. Now the great city was divided in three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. And great Babylon was remembered for God to give her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of her wrath. Then every island and mountain were not found. Remember the plates and the islands and mountains moving? Where did that island go to? Subducted underneath. Then every island fled, and the mountains were not found, and the great hail from heaven fell upon men, each hailstone about the weight of a talent, about 75 pounds. Men blasphemed God. Did they repent? Men blasphemed God because of the plague and of the hail, since that plague was exceedingly great. Let's go to 18, chapter 18. Then a mighty angel took a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found anymore. Many people believe that Rome is Babylon, the center of the beast power. You remember, we're not going to even go there, but you remember reading about men who cursed God because of the heat? You know, how hot it was? Why is it so hot? Atmosphere has been destroyed. Ozone layer is gone. You're closer to the sun. I mean, those are not uniformitarian events, brethren. So we haven't even read everything in Revelation. But what I want you to notice, brethren, is that the Bible is a very catastrophic book. There are many famous scientists who are catastrophists. In other words, they believed what you and I just what you and I have been reading. They believed those things occurred. Some of them were, for example, Joseph Lister. You remember? You heard of the antiseptic Listerine? Joseph Lister. He's the one that told the doctors to wash their hands, and the doctor said, "Who are you to tell us what to do? We're not going to wash our hands. You're making it sound like we're infecting women who are pregnant." They were. When he had his doctors wash their hands. The death rate for women pregnant was about 19%. You had about 1 in 4 chance of dying if you were pregnant if you went to the hospital. Because doctors would go from one patient to the other without washing their hands. Lister said, wash your hands. And they got offended at him. You know what happened? When his doctor started washing their hands, the death rate fell to less than 1%. Just by washing their hands. You think that scientists are very knowledgeable and that they're very, you know, that they're not prejudiced and that they will listen. No, they're not. They're human just like you are. They get offended the same way you do. Scary thought, isn't it? Other people that believed in things we're talking about. Isaac Newton. You know who Isaac Newton was? Celestial mechanics. Johann Kepler. He's the one that said that the... he's the one that studied a lot of the stars. We have Robert Boyle, gas laws, pressure, volume, temperature, all related. We had Gregor Mendel, you remember the peas and the heredity. You've got Louis Pasteur. He's the one that said if you boil milk and don't let things get in it, it's going to stay sterile forever. That's why we have pasteurization. Every time you drink milk and eat some cookies, you're giving homage to Louis Pasteur. Which means that evolution is not true because things don't arise from dead things. You've got Lord Kelvin. Lord Kelvin was one that developed some laws about thermodynamics. You've heard of Kelvin temperature? Gave him his name. Others were Michael Faraday, discovered some of the laws of electricity. There were hundreds of them. Most of your 18th century scientists and philosophers were all catastrophists. because they had great respect for the Bible, brethren. And there are people telling you that the Bible is not correct, that the Bible doesn't know what it's talking about, and that the theory of uniformitarianism is the way to go nowadays. The earth has been affected by catastrophes in the past and will be affected by catastrophes in the future. The Old Testament writings and prophecies prove this. Jesus Christ is going to return soon, brethren. He's going to return and he's going to establish his kingdom. When he returns, he will reshape the earth and convert it into a paradise. The earth is not static, brethren. It still has to go through many changes.